Hello and welcome, one and all, to the latest Global in the Granite State, a program of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. As always, my name is Tim Horgan, and I am the Executive Director of the Council, as well as your host for this monthly series. We have another great episode coming up for you, and I am so honored that you have taken the time to tune in. For those who may not know, the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that centers itself at the forefront of global conversations in order to provide you the opportunity to better understand the world. As a community-supported nonprofit, I want to thank all of our amazing members, donors, supporters, and sponsors who make our work possible. It is an honor that we have such a strong community of globally focused supporters that we can tackle challenging issues with throughout the year. A special thank you to McLean Middleton, our longtime podcast sponsor, for your critical support. McLean Middleton is one of New England's premier full-service law firms with over 100 attorneys throughout offices in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. McLean Middleton's attorneys have been providing trusted legal services to businesses throughout the region for over 100 years. Learn more at McLean.com. Before we get started, if you are not yet a member, hop over to our website and support this critical work today. More at WACNH.org. Now, onto the show.
That the Russians undertake in the region are, in my view, entirely transactional. They're not doing anything because it seems to be the right thing for them to do. It's the right thing for the region. They do things that are in their interest.
This is Vice Admiral John W. Miller, a 36-year veteran of the United States Navy, commander of several warships, including the aircraft carrier Constellation, an F-14 navigator, and a flag officer across the Middle East. He visited New Hampshire as part of the U.S. Global Leadership Coalition's work to build understanding of the importance of global issues, specifically the intersection of diplomacy, development, and defense. We were honored to have the opportunity to speak with him and gain his insights into the Russian history of engagement in the Middle East and why it is important for the United States to understand the country's goal in the region.
And where their interests align with other countries in the region, like Syria and like Iran in particular, then they get along well. And you see that working to the Russian advantage today, because the Iranians are producing some good quality unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, and they're exporting them to Russia. And those drones are used to help the Russians in the fight against the Ukrainians. So obviously something that remains of concern to the United States.
It has not always been the case that the Russians slash the Soviets have had a deep and strong relationship with the region, as was most notably demonstrated through the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s, after having close ties to the government going back to at least 1955. Also, after their withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, what was left of Russia retreated from the region for the next 30 years or so.
There was a period of time right after the fall of the Soviet Union where Russia sort of fell off the map. When I was a young officer in the Navy, I made 5 or 6 consecutive deployments to the Mediterranean Sea. The Russian Navy was there in full force, surface units, cruisers, destroyers, occasional aircraft carrier, submarines, and they had a presence. They had anchorages off the coast of Libya. They had access to some of the ports in Syria. And then the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union fell. There was no longer a Russian naval presence or military presence in the region. In their sphere of influence during the Cold War days, they had the Egyptians, they had the Syrians. They had access to warm water ports. So the ability to go from Crimea, which was at one point part of the Soviet Union, through the Black Sea into the Mediterranean Sea and then find ports. But then they just stopped doing it. And so that situation stayed that way until the Syrian civil war.
Before we hop into the relationships that Russia maintains in the region today, which started with an intervention in the Syrian civil war, let's take a look at what interest Russia has in the Middle East.
Some of them do revolve around oil and gas, and I'm not one that would tell you that our sole interest in the Middle East is the oil and gas, but you can't ignore the fact that there are significant deposits of both, and they have to transit through the Strait of Hormuz to get to the places that they need to go, primarily over into Asia, so across the Indian Ocean and through the Strait of Malacca. But Russia does have an interest in oil and gas being more expensive than it is, and so they're interested in doing things that help keep the price of oil and gas higher than it might naturally be. Iran helps them with that because it aligns with Iranian interests, not because they're interested necessarily in helping the Russians or the Russians are necessarily interested in helping them. It's because they both benefit from higher oil and gas prices. And so when you create this sort of instability in the region, you create doubt about the ability of oil and gas to transit through the region, whether it's in the Red Sea, so Bab el-Mandeb on the southern end, the Suez Canal on the northern end, or through the Strait of Hormuz. They both benefit from the fact that oil and gas prices get stressed, they go up, and they make more money. Interestingly, despite the sanctions, I think the Russians are better off economically today than they were before the war in Ukraine started. And so because of the way they've set themselves up with the Europeans in particular, it actually has been a money maker for them, and they're using that money to produce war materials.
In addition, as the United States has tried to focus its time and attention elsewhere, this has provided Russia with another reason to remain engaged in this region.
The U.S. has lacked presence and leadership over the last decade, for sure, in the region. In 2013, we came out with a security strategy that said we are going to pivot to the Pacific, maybe one of the worst diplomatic phrases in history. You know, it's a little bit like the new Coke. So we changed the terminology, but what's not lost, and it's still in our national security strategy, what's not lost on anyone is that we are more interested in things that are happening in the Pacific because it's a greater threat to the United States and really to the rest of the world in terms of the Chinese desire to establish a new world order. The Russians are part of that effort because it's in their interest to do things that aren't in our interest, and it helps keep us involved in places maybe we would like to be less militarily involved, and it prevents us to a certain extent from exercising the kind of diplomatic initiatives that we'd like to be able to do because of the feeling on a part of many of the nations in the Middle East that we're not as interested. And so it doesn't matter, and what we say we may not back up with specific actions. And so you see wherever there's an opportunity, you see malign Russian activity. We see it to this day in Syria. We see it to a lesser extent in Iraq. But they're going to continue to remain involved because it takes up time and intellectual energy on the part of our diplomatic community and physical energy on the part of our military.
As Vice Admiral Miller mentioned earlier, the Russians regained a foothold in the region due to the Syrian civil war. While Russia had maintained relations with Syria for quite a while, it was considered one of the few remaining friends it had in the region. After the toppling of Gaddafi in Libya, Russia began to worry that the fall of the Assad regime would lead to a further drop in prestige for Russia and diminish the power of their security guarantees. In addition, the Russian government has feared successful revolutions, particularly in majority Muslim countries, as they have fought a long civil war in the Chechnya region led by Islamic forces for decades or even centuries, depending on how you count it. So, when the civil war broke out in Syria and Assad used chemical weapons against his own people, it was a strategic opportunity for Russia to step in and achieve strategic goals.
President Obama had a red line. The red line was if Assad uses chemical weapons against his people, you know, that'll be a red line. He crossed that red line, and before military action was taken, the Russians came in and volunteered. They said, hey, we will help you get rid of the chemical weapons coming out of Syria. And the United States, along with the United Nations, agreed with that. And it had been about 30 years since the Russians or the Soviets had really been involved anywhere in the Middle East. So it gave them an opening that they hadn't had before. it had the good effect of, in fact, getting rid of chemical weapons. There's a whole process that we worked, the United States and the UN worked closely with the Russians to get these chemical weapons out. They went to a ship in the Mediterranean that could convert these chemicals into things that were inert and not harmful to people. And so from that point, it was a success. The flip side of that, of course, is it gave the Russians an opportunity to be back in force in the region, and in particular in Syria, because they had a land port, an airport, and a seaport that they had access to. And that was the first time they'd had that kind of access since the Cold War had ended. They've taken good advantage of that in order to prop up the Assad regime. If it were not for the Russian intervention in Syria, Assad would have been out of power long ago. The Syrians were on their last legs. The Iranians had come in with IRGC and Hezbollah forces, and they were losing. And so it was really only a matter of time unless someone intervened on Assad's behalf, and that's what the Russians have done. And so that civil war goes on to this day.
While the war does continue today, Assad has regained control of the majority of the country's territory, and the forces aligned against the government have lost most of their international support. There are some Western troops still in the northeast of the country, but effectively, Assad is back in control. He's been welcomed back into the international forums, and many countries have reestablished relationships with the regime. These are clear wins for Russia and the reliability of their security guarantees. There are other wins that Russia has seen from this intervention as well.
I think there's a couple reasons behind their support for the regime, not the least of which is that a Syria that's friendly to Russia, and a Syria in particular that's friendly to Iran, is a Syria that is a route for the shipment of weapons through Syria and into other places. In particular, I'm talking about southern Lebanon. And so support for Hezbollah. That is a primary pursuit and goal of the Iranian regime, is to continue to support Hezbollah. Outside the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Forces, Hezbollah is their most important military arm. Hezbollah does some other things in southern Lebanon in terms of education, hospitals, maintenance, and that sort of thing. But primarily, they're a military organization. They fought in Syria. They did not fare well in Syria, nor did the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. So the Russians stepped in because a Syria that's friendly to them gives them access to a port and to an airport in the eastern Mediterranean. And it gives Iran the ability to continue to support Hezbollah, which puts pressure on Israel. Their interest doesn't stop with Iran, nor does it stop with Syria. They're interested in having influence throughout the region. It's one of the things we saw in the region starting in the 2013 timeframe, where we were not approving a lot of military sales, foreign military sales. And so countries like Bahrain, which is very friendly to the U.S., and we have an historic and lengthy relationship, began to go visit Moscow because they were looking for weapons that they could get from the Russians that they can't get from the United States. The Emiratis have bought military equipment from the Russians. The other countries are looking at the same thing. So the Russians are always looking to pick up hard currency.
Now, why is it that the Russians are so interested in getting their hands on as much hard currency as possible? One main reason is the Western-led sanctions that have been placed on the country after the second invasion of Ukraine in 2022. While these sanctions have not been universally adopted, even by all NATO members, these sanctions have made it more difficult for Russia to operate its economy. This includes around $300 billion worth of assets frozen by central banks around the world. Of course, Russia's economy has not collapsed. However, they have seen negative growth over the past 2 years. It may be difficult to remember the early days of the invasion, or even prior to the invasion, where military analysts predicted that Russia would run roughshod over Ukraine and take the capital in 48 hours. While the Russians now only control about 18% of Ukraine's land, there's still a long path forward to making this country whole again. Despite how things played out on the ground, there are many reasons that Russia, and many outside analysts, thought that this would be an easy win for the country.
There are two events, I think, that translate into Russian confidence that an invasion into Ukraine would be a matter of a few days before they were in Kyiv and installing a puppet government that was friendly to Moscow. The first was the 2014 takeover of Crimea, which was done virtually without shot being fired. Bloodless. The whole world watched. No one did anything. And frankly, even the Ukrainians didn't raise enough of an alarm to garner a lot of opinion from the world about it. Just sort of, you know, you woke up one day and the Russians were in charge of Crimea, and nobody seemed to really think that that was terribly important. So I think that gave them confidence in what they could do freedom of action-wise, but also confidence in their military. I think the same is true with their military successes in Syria. Obviously, a very different military situation than what they face in Ukraine. And so they didn't project well that what happened in Syria does not equal what's going to happen when we attack the part of a country that has said it's going to defend itself. And by the time the Russians actually invaded, the Ukrainians were receiving military aid from other places, including from the United States, which hadn't been true in 2014. I think it's important to remember that a lot of the forces that fight in Syria from the beginning of Russian involvement weren't Russian soldiers. They were mercenaries, Wagner Group folks for the most part, and they fight a different sort of war. It's brutal, scorched earth. It's how they acted in Chechnya, it's how they acted in Georgia, and it's how they acted in Syria, much to the disadvantage of the Syrian people and the rich culture and heritage that Syria represents that people will now never have a chance to see. I think all those things together combined to make them think that they could just roll over the Ukrainian armed forces in a matter of a few days. I have to admit, I was one of the guys that when people said 3 days to Kyiv, okay, I think that's probably about right based on what we've seen. Turns out they were nowhere near as good as we thought they were, and they were nowhere near as good as they thought they were.
This is one of the key reasons that Russia has continued to engage in wars throughout the Middle East, or at least supplying regimes in the region, something that the United States and its partners have benefited from as well. The opportunity to test new weapon systems and grow their defense industrial base by being an arms supplier. After the Russian-Georgian War of 2008, the Russian military learned of several weaknesses that they planned to address while modernizing their army by 2020. Syria provided a perfect proving ground for many of the new weapons, 70% of which were modernized between 2008 and 2017, and new special forces that operated on the ground in Syria. A particular point of emphasis after the war in Georgia was placed on the use of air superiority, which has been a major feature of the campaign in Syria. They have been testing new stealth fighters by basing them at Syrian air bases. Another connection to the Middle East and the war in Ukraine, of course, is the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. While many have called the United States government hypocritical for supporting Ukraine while also supporting Israel, this has not changed the United States' government's approach. However, it is important to note Russia's interest in this war.
Well, I think they're much more connected to the Palestinian state, and to be honest with you, as odd as this may sound, the invasion of Israel by Hamas in October was the best thing that happened to the Russians in a couple of years. Because all of a sudden, the eyes of the world, which had been staring at Ukraine, and then the aid that followed from what we were seeing, suddenly became much more complicated and complex. I don't think at the end of the day the Russians really care if there's a one-state solution, two-state solution, three-state solution. I don't think it really matters to them from a strategic standpoint, but I do think they benefit from what's happening. And so when we have discussions, for example, in our Congress, first of all, it was about aid to Ukraine. Then it was about aid to Ukraine and Israel. Now it's about aid to Ukraine and Israel on the southern border. And anytime you can make that more complicated, the less likely it is you're going to get anything productive done. And I think Russia finds that advantageous. I don't think that the Russians are actively in favor of Israel no longer being a nation state. I don't think they're that concerned one way or another, but I do think they see an opportunity to help themselves because sort of the global battlefield has changed fairly significantly.
It is an interesting place that Russia, Ukraine, the United States, its partners, Israel, and the Palestinians find themselves in today. These conflicts, fought for wildly different reasons, in locations thousands of miles apart, involving vastly different peoples, seem intrinsically linked to each other. Now, I understand that the statement I'm going to make here is hugely idealistic and probably unrealistic, but I will stand by it regardless. If countries could come together to build an understanding of each other, that our shared humanity should be at the center of our efforts in global relations, and that it is possible to coexist without threatening the use of force, peoples, lives would be much better. Of course, there are untold numbers of people, non-state actors, and transnational criminal organizations that would have to be brought under control as well. But at the end of the day, anyone who cares about the preservation of life, not putting one life above the other, should see the value in this effort, which the United States continues to pursue. But I will leave it up to you to assess how effective they are at that mission. Speaking of collaboration, Russia and the United States did have a 25-year window where they were actually able to work together towards the goals of making the world a better place. This came to an end, for many reasons, with the last major achievement that these two states were able to jointly negotiate, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Deal. Even though in 2015 U.S.-Russian relations were not doing well, they still came together with the other leading nations to hammer out a deal that would, at the very least, slow the Iranian nuclear research. Perhaps in another episode we can more fully explore the flaws and successes of that deal, but it highlights what can happen when Russian and U.S. interests do align. Despite this, it will be a long time before these two countries are able to work together again on major international issues.
Well, I think it's going to be a long time before we work with Russia again. And maybe not well known, but our diplomatic relations with Russia took a real step. Our relations with Russia, not just diplomatic, but military and otherwise, took a major step back when they invaded Crimea in the aftermath of that. It'll be a while, I think, before we find that we're going to trust the Russians enough again to be able to work with them in areas of diplomacy. So expansion of the Abraham Accords, for example, a new agreement regarding nuclear weapons and development in Iran. It's in everybody's interest, including the Russians, that the Iranians don't develop nuclear weapons. I'm not sure that the world is ready to undertake that kind of endeavor again, in part because of how we got out of the JCPOA. But I will tell you, the deal was structurally, fundamentally flawed right from the beginning. It wasn't a treaty. It wasn't ratified by Congress. It was effectively ratified through executive order and through the United Nations. And so until you can get something more enduring that all the parties that are involved in will sign up to, that transcends administrations, whether it be in Russia, the U.S., the U.K., or anywhere else. I don't see major diplomatic initiatives coming out of the region that involve us and the Russians.
At the end of the day, this is a bad thing, as there are so many global issues that require joint action. And while Russia is not the superpower it once was, it certainly has shown itself as willing to disrupt where it can and to work against global action where that country feels it is in their interest. Now, from a U.S. perspective, our listeners may be wondering, well, the U.S. government has been trying to shift away from the Middle East for over a decade. We're tired of this constant state of conflict that this region seems to be in. So let's just let Russia have their day with this part of the world that continues to be a headache for any international power that has tried to bring peace and stability. To many, it may also seem, and is backed up by real evidence, that many in the region do not view the U.S. positively or as a reliable partner. So why should we even care to help these people?
So on the U.S. side, because I think you need to take it in two parts, on the U.S. side, there is plenty of evidence, not anecdotal evidence, but evidence, that we are a less than trusted partner in the region. And Afghanistan is certainly the most glaring example. And it wasn't necessarily that we left Afghanistan, although we were in a pretty good place with 2,500 troops, none of them really in harm's way. The Afghan National Army being supplied with air power from the U.S. and NATO and intelligence from the U.S. and NATO, able to fend off the Taliban. Then we left, and we left very abruptly. We left not only with the Afghan National Army kind of holding the bag, but we left a lot of our allies in lurch, and of course we left a lot of people behind, had really committed their lives to the success of a new Afghanistan. So we can't think that that's not high on the list of things that people in the region remember.
I want to jump in here and provide some context that I think is missing from a lot of the insights into why the Afghanistan National Army fared so poorly upon the U.S. exit. Yes, the abruptness of the departure, the fleeing of the president, the phantom regiments, and corruption all played a part. But not many people talk about the thousands of Western contractors who were in the country supporting the National Army with logistics, mechanics to maintain aircraft, technologists running sophisticated and proprietary technology that helps the Army understand and react to threats. Okay, Now, back to Vice Admiral Miller on why the question of Russian engagement in the region matters.
And then there are other things. It was what happened in Egypt and the events that led to Sisi coming into power. You look at some other things. There was attacks by Iranian IRGC or Iranian proxies into the Gulf states that largely went unanswered, and the U.S. seemed largely unconcerned. So what kind of a security partnership is it if you get attacked and your security partner isn't really willing to do anything about it? So all of those things are true, and they lead to a lack of confidence in the U.S. as a partner in the region and everywhere else in the world. So that it doesn't just have implications in the Middle East. It spreads everywhere, including all the way to Taiwan. That said, that doesn't make Russia a stable or good partner, because they're not stable and they're not a good partner. They're going to get what they can get out of any kind of a relationship. They're not there to make the region more stable. I mean, the heart of our existence in the Middle East for decades now, that goes all the way back to World War II, has been to make sure that the region remains peaceful and stable and the people can thrive. The Russians don't care if it's peaceful or stable. Like I said earlier, they benefit from higher oil prices. We often forget a lot of oil and gas goes out of the Gulf, but a lot of things, commodities, go in, because they're growing populations, they're reliant on maritime trade. A country like the UAE gets something like 90% of its food from the sea. And you know, it's not delivered over land. It's not produced indigenously. And so if you had to choose between the U.S. and Russia today, I'd say you're in a difficult position, because we've not shown ourselves, particularly the last decade or so. That transcends a number of administrations. We've not presented ourselves as a particularly reliable ally. We've not taken advantage of the fact that most of the countries in that region would like us to be a reliable ally. You know, we have a history with them. We have relationships with them. We sell them a lot of military equipment. That could be used to the advantage of all to make the region more stable if we provided the leadership and the policy that allowed them to understand that we are a good partner and we're in it for the long haul, because we should be.
As we round out today's discussion, I asked Vice Admiral Miller to provide some insights on why he believes that America and Americans should remain engaged and interested in the world.
I think it is absolutely true that the world is a better place when the United States is out and about in that world. Some of that is through military presence, and when we look at where we have military presence, we're in a lot of different places. And while we don't have huge numbers of troops deployed anywhere, we have significant numbers in many places around the world, including in Japan, in Korea, in Europe. And all of those deployments added together make the world a safer place. What that military commitment also tees up for us, and also allows the United States to do, is to be more powerful in the diplomatic world and in diplomatic discussions. But we need a consistency to that and an understanding amongst the people in the world, much like they had during the Cold War. Everybody in the world knew that the United States was not going to give up and lose the Cold War to the Soviet Union. Everybody in the world needs to know today that we will stand up for justice and for peace and for stability and for security around the world. And if you're prepared to do that militarily, generally you don't have to. You can do it diplomatically. You can do it through developmental aid, which the United States is better at doing than just about anybody. And it's not just giving people things, it's teaching people things or providing the ability to build the infrastructure that they need for good roads, electrical grid that supplies the people so that they can have clean water and a good food supply, all those things. So an America that is out and about is an investment in America. It's not an investment just in the world. It's also an investment in our own country.
Thank you for listening today, and thank you to Vice Admiral Miller for taking the time to share his insights. This has been The Global in the Granite State. a program of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. We appreciate your interest and support in continuing these conversations, and I hope that you have learned some new insights, had your perspective challenged, and that you will share this with your own network. The more global conversations we can have, the better a world we can create. No one person can row this huge global ship on their own, but if we all start rowing in the same direction, we can achieve amazing things. Tim Horgan is your host, producer, director, audio engineer, researcher, editor, scriptwriter, fact checker, and whatever else you can think of for this podcast. Our theme music is Admin by AA Alto, and our interlude music is Deep Future Garage by Royalty Free Music. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you will tune in next month.